then it goes on to really contextualizing the child in his or her network. The idea being that the more the child has a supportive network and that they can use this network, the more they will be able to face the aspects of COVID-19. So not only the illness and having people in the family are ill or might have died, but also the other impacts of COVID-19, which is to livelihood.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms, on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Jennifer Davids. Jennifer Davids is a psychoanalyst, child, adolescent, and adult analyst, member of the British Psychoanalytical Society and the IPA, and she is the director of Africa Projects, the Children's Psychological Health Center in San Francisco. Our conversation today is about a workbook, and this is a workbook designed to speak to children and give children a place to speak. It's a workbook that originated in the States, originally designed by Dr. Gilbert Kleiman for an American population and audience, again, to give children a place to reflect on their experience, specifically of the COVID world that they're all living in now. And Jennifer and Gil and a team from South Africa worked to modify this workbook to make it useful and applicable to a materially disadvantaged community in South Africa, the home, the birth home of Jennifer. And she describes to us the process of transforming it into a South African community instrument. She describes what the vehicle is and how it helps children take the raw experience of trauma and transform it into words and self-reflections and self-awareness, both one's own individual voice and also how it helps them become part of their local community, their chorus, if you will. She also reports on the obstacles, the intrapsychic obstacles, the cultural obstacles, the political obstacles, and the historical obstacles that we all know about. We all know it's not an easy pathway to go from raw, unrepresented affects and feelings into words and images and drawings. She describes those obstacles and how she and the people working with her to administer these workbooks to these kids, and we'll talk about their two workbooks and different ages. There are all kinds of details. And it's a fascinating journey into a part of the world that most of us aren't acquainted with, and most of us don't have a guide as thoughtful and immersed in that community as Jennifer David is as our guide. She also shares with us a bit about her personal history, about what brought her to do this work. And I got a real education. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Here's my conversation with Jennifer Davids. Mm-hmm. Jenny, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Jenny, we know it's a challenge to make mental health outreach to materially impoverished communities in many places, especially in South Africa, where we're going to learn a great deal about today. And we know it's an extra challenge in the time of COVID. And to add to that, the kinds of outreach that you're interested in doing is dynamically sophisticated outreach. And you put those elements together, and it's really a daunting task. Now, Jenny, you and I have worked together for some time on the IPA and Health Committee. And we've come to know each other. And one of the things I have learned about you is that when you are faced with a daunting challenge, you embrace it. You don't avoid it, like many of us would be inclined to. And especially when that challenge involves your country of birth, South Africa. And so you did embrace this challenge, and you looked around for resources, and you put together a team. And one of the people you've chose to work with is Dr. Gilbert Kleiman. Now, many people listening to this probably know Gil Kleiman, both because he's internationally known for his remarkable work making mental health resources available to people who otherwise have no access to it. I also had the privilege of interviewing him on this podcast last March before the pandemic. It's episode 39, if somebody wants to hear it. And we discuss his really remarkable program of reflective network therapy, which, when applied to children, demonstrably makes major cognitive and emotional changes in their lives, including significant improvements in their IQ functioning. So he's really making a major contribution. And you reached out to him, and it turns out that he had put together a workbook for American children to deal with this really worldwide calamity that they were facing in their lives. And their workbook was called My Pandemic Story 2020. And you and he and your team worked together to apply that workbook to the South African situation. And you worked and adopted it and modified it and continue to have done so ever since it was first put out. I've had the pleasure of reading your workbook called My South African Pandemic Story. And it's really a gift. And you and your group do something that I really value in professionals. You take very nuanced, complicated concepts, and you make it simple seeming and user friendly. And that's just what you've done with this. And before I invite you to describe for our listeners what the workbook is, I'm going to quote something you've written about it that really captures it. You say the workbook is to provide the beginnings of transformation of raw experience of trauma in a materially poor population, which has a history of HIV and TB, into higher order representation and symbolization in drawing and narrative, which really captures what your goal and what your effort is. Jenny, tell us about the workbook.
Right. Well, thank you. Well, the workbooks that have emerged from our group, which includes Patty Silbert and Tembi Mozaliana from the University of Cape Town, a project which works in a school in Khayelitsha, are really adaptations which began over Zoom. This whole project was done over Zoom. So arranging, you can imagine the time zones, Dr. Kline in California and Cape Town, often they were staying up late to have these Zoom meetings. That's how enthusiastic they were about trying to apply and modify the workbook. So the workbooks are really, they're quite long, and they're in printed form because the people in this township, which has got 490,000 people living in it, don't have access to computers. Some of them do, but most of them don't. So it was actually rolled out in printed form in the schools. And it is an invitation. Each child gets his or her own workbook. And it's an invitation to learn something about the pandemic, about previous pandemics, because, of course, as you mentioned, there have been previously HIV and TB still going on in South Africa, and to learn something about what they are facing in this model of actively coping with trauma. And so the workbook consists of both reading about the pandemic, then starting to think about oneself. So, for example, one of the invitations is to draw a picture of yourself.
Now, what age group is this directed at? This, I know there are more than one version of the workbook.
Yes. The drawing a self-portrait is actually in both the workbook for adolescents and in the workbook for 8 to 11-year-olds. So in both the workbooks, there's the invitation to draw a picture of myself. And then it goes on to really contextualizing the child in his or her network. The idea being that the more the child has a supportive network and that they can use this network, the more they will be able to face the aspects of COVID-19. So not only the illness and having, if people in the family are ill or might have died, but also the other impacts of COVID-19, which is to livelihood, that some of these children would have been getting food at school through the National Feeding Scheme. So some of them might actually be hungry and worried about money and all this sort of thing. So trying to get them to think, who's helpful? Who can I turn to? Whether my friends, maybe my caregivers, the teachers, obviously, who can I turn to? And sometimes the children are invited to draw a picture of somebody, of them with somebody who they trust. They also ask to draw in the workbook, they draw a picture of what life was like before the pandemic. And one of the kids drew herself lying on a beach, on a towel on a beach in the sun, a really cool picture before this terrible situation hit. Other things that they invited to do is, for example, if I could have one dream to come true right now, and you write it inside the star, which is a big star, and they can write it. This workbook, you can respond to it in Khoza, which is one of the languages spoken in Khayelitsha, or you could respond to it in English, whichever you prefer. The children also don't have to do it in a linear way. They can choose which section they would like to work on. They can also refuse and say, I don't want to work on this thing. So it's very child-centered approach, very much like an analytic session, following the patient, or this time the learner, as they're called in South Africa. Just to give one example of a response to, if I could have one dream to come true right now, which I think reflects the South African situation quite well, is one child who was 13 years old wrote, I want to help children who did not have a home and their mothers did not want them. Other children said, this book makes me feel I'm talking to my best friend. The book also goes on to, apart from the resources that the children can use, also how they felt about when they heard about the pandemic, what they felt, what they thought. It also involves, for younger children, colouring in, and they can colour it in with the person at school who might be helping them to work on the workbook as a sort of secretary reporter. They talk about their worries, talk about things that make them feel better.
You mentioned the person who's helping them, and in what I've read, you make a point that this is both an exercise for the child, but it's also relational because there are adults and teachers and the librarians that are helping them put their thoughts and images together. So there's also a relational context to working on this workbook. Do I have that right?
Very much so. In fact, the workbooks were rolled out in the library of the school. They've got a rather nice library. So it wasn't only with the library assistants and the social work students who were helping to roll it out, but it was also with the group of their peers. So some of them wrote poetry in response to the workbook. Huh. And they would get up, this one young woman, very confident, she got up and she shared her poem. So it's very much a group exercise. And we got some wonderful photographs of the kids wearing masks, of course, and doing this workbook.
It must have been meaningful for the adults as well.
Yes, I think very much so. And there's a very complicated relationship between the school and the parents and caregivers of the kids, in that the school isn't always aware or confident of how it's going down at home or whether the children are even showing the workbook to their parents, especially the adolescents, because they've sort of treated it as a kind of diary. But yes, it is very much drawing on the sense of community and drawing on Dr. Kleiman's model, which I particularly like, the hands model of giving children hands. And hands stands for honesty, for actively coping, for the network, and for the D and the S are developmentally specific ways of understanding things. So it's something about, I think why it sort of partly went down well in the South African context was they like the idea of hands, and of course of finding one's voice is very, very important in a disenfranchised, or it was a disenfranchised population. And I think this is particularly important because some of the young children, adolescents, are highly politicized in that context. So it's a very, very important that they can express their feelings.
And you're describing they're finding their voice both as a solo voice and as part of their chorus too.
Yes, very much so. The workbook also has a questionnaire which has been translated into Khoza, which was an American-based questionnaire. And in the latest modification of the workbook, my South African colleagues have actually changed it and asked questions that they feel are more pertinent to the township situation. But they're basically searching for the children showing or noticing behaviors or thoughts that they don't normally have. So difficulties in sleeping, not being interested in doing things they normally do, somatic problems, you know, all sorts of traumatic kind of responses that you might find. And if the children do have these manifestations, they then can go to speak to somebody in the school who's trained to deal with such difficulties.
So it serves as a screening device for symptoms.
Yes. And so that's really how the workbook works. And then as the time has gone on, it's been very interesting to From the start, we tried to Africanize it because we know from community projects that it has to be in the language and the culture of the locality. Otherwise, it won't work. But it became deeper that as we tried to review the project and evaluate it, I think it was around December time, that I really sort of had a bit of a double take. And I thought, you know, are we going down the right path here? And then I spoke to an old colleague of mine or ex-teacher of mine, Professor Andy Dawes, and also Jonathan Morgan, who's a very well-known person in psychosocial projects in Africa, on the African continent, and started to realize that my instinct that it wasn't quite fitting the African context was probably right. And they both pointed out the poor literacy levels of some of the children in the townships, and also some of the cultural differences. So, for example, in adolescence in the townships, there is enormous emphasis placed on autonomy and on invulnerability, that you don't show what you are feeling and what you're vulnerable, that you've got to be tough. And also, Professor Dawes made me very aware that to put somebody died, who died, to actually write, has anybody in your family died? And to answer that, first of all, in the context of South African history, to write anything down that can be seen by somebody else, there's still an enormous suspiciousness coming from the old days of apartheid.
Yeah, explain that. I was surprised when you had first told me the inhibition to write.
Well, first of all, in many African tribes, there is more of an oral tradition. So you would tell stories. It's knowledge is passed down orally rather than through a written tradition. But of course, that's a little bit of a stereotype because a lot of Western ways have infiltrated into the African continent and into sophisticated African countries. So it's a bit of a hybrid. But there's still a feeling that if you write something down, somebody else can read it, somebody else can pass it on. The sort of paranoia of living in the apartheid era where you never knew who you could trust. It's not even really paranoia, it's more objective anxiety that it could happen. And so there's a sort of a reticence that if you actually write it down, what would happen? But also on a more anthropological side, that you perhaps shouldn't write down too much about your feelings and thoughts about the people who've died, or even talk about them, because that, in some African culture, that would be considered that you were not respecting the ancestors enough. So these are different cultural beliefs. Also realizing, I think, in this last phase, December, January, February, March, realizing that the model of Dr. Kleiman is a post-traumatic stress model. And I think a more fitting model is one that was actually developed in South Africa during the struggle. And it's called CTS, which means continuous traumatic stress. And it's the person who thought of it was a psychologist, Jill Straker, who's actually published in many international journals, including American ones. And she thought of this concept during the apartheid era when people were activists who were under stress and who needed therapy and who suffered from continuous stress, the CTS, and it was realistic. Like, so for example, they had to think where they could have therapy, where there would be a safe place. And this relates to the workbook as well, because safety is very much a thing. Where can you speak? And that's why I think school has got such a significance for these children. It's such a haven for them where they can perhaps do different things than they do at home.
Saying that there's more freedom to speak openly at school than there is at home?
There might be, because the parents or the caregivers might have adopted an approach of not talking.
I see.
And they might also not be so well physically and mentally. I mean, there's a quite a lot of unemployment in the Khayelitsha. Mm. I was reading that for young men under the age of 23, that 50% of them are unemployed.
So that would expose the child potentially to feeling that they're being transgressive if they actually speak their thoughts, much less write them down?
Yes, there would be an anxiety to some degree. It still would be, but because you're still sort of not quite trusting. And also there are gangs in Khayelitsha as well, gangs operating. It's quite a high-stress environment.
So these are the obstacles you have in having the workbook work. That is that there were all these hesitancies for the kids and teenagers to be able to both identify their inner experience and then to feel part of a community that shares that inner experience and then to say it and to write it and to draw it. There are hurdles at each step that had to be overcome, presumably with the helpful influence of the social workers, the librarians, the teachers.
Yes. And also the idea of some of the children who are a little blunted, that they feel, pandemic. Well, that's just another, it's another thing that's happening here. This is just a long list of the kind of stresses that they live with. Although Tembi, who's the social worker on the ground, she said that she felt that the workbooks are a gateway. To an invitation to not necessarily only talk about COVID, but that other things come up as the conversations begin. So she saw that as also quite useful, that as a sort of invitation for other stresses to be talked about.
Huh, how useful. And again, these are people who, needless to say, would not have had contacts with social workers or mental health providers in any other setting but through the vehicle of the workbook.
No, they through the school, which is part of the University of Cape Town's initiative to reach out into the community. Before the pandemic, Tembi was already working. And then the social work students from the university come and do projects in the townships. So there is some mental health facilities already there. They're very fortunate because of the university's backing and interest in reaching out into the townships.
Can you tell us a bit about that outreach? That sounds vital, both for the university and for the community.
Absolutely. The University, of course, of Cape Town, which is one of the oldest international universities on the African continent, and I think it's in the top 200 universities in the world. So it's a very good university. It's also my alma mater.
Yes, I know that.
It really, as you know, throughout the apartheid era, always trying to do projects on the ground. I mean, I remember when I was a young student working in Khayelitsha, going to help children read in the township. Always had these kind of outreach projects, but this is a more in the post-apartheid era of actually using alumni's money. So people who might be living in Australia or America or, I don't know, wherever, England, you know, give money to the university for projects like this, and then they set them up. And so this is a beautiful school. When I first made contact with UCT, Patty sent me this film of the school, a beautiful building, and the children, you know, dressed, you know, very proudly in their school uniforms, interviewed mm-hmm. and speaking very articulately. This particular school is focused on science and technology. So it's trying to help those children who might go into those fields and become the future scientists and technologists of South Africa. And it's a really, as the children really seem to value their school, their teachers, and to know that this school wants them, is on the side of their well-being. So it's very important to the kids, and it's very important to the university that hopefully some of these children will come to the university and study there.
Let's just italicize that statement, because that's so vital in many of the conversations I have on this podcast. They're related to what you just said. The kids know that the school is on their side and wants them to succeed. What a vital piece of interaction, if you will, that we find in healthy families, in healthy communities, in healthy therapeutic treatments, where the individual has a sense that the person they're engaged with has an interest in their succeeding. That must be enormously powerful for them.
Very powerful. And also I noticed that on this film that I saw, that the children, especially the adolescents, are very much identified with their teachers and the social worker, noticing right. that they have a proud African identity and wanting to be like them. So very powerful identifications.
Where do you see this workbook going? What's the next phase of its presence in this community?
Well, I think the next part that they're focusing on is translating the workbook for the younger children, those were sort of 7 to 11, into Khoza, which I hadn't realized is so expensive. Apparently, the translators charge enormous fees, which is, of course, difficult, and they have to raise funds for it, which is not always so easy. They also, Tembi and Patty, have been working with the Cape Metro Education, which is actually part of the government of that part of South Africa, and they're hoping to roll it out into several schools. So this is a bit of a pilot project, and then I think they're hoping to roll it out, because unfortunately, as COVID continues, and in South Africa, of course, most of the population are still waiting for their vaccines.
Sure.
There are going to be more deaths and more illnesses and more bereavement. So I think it will really be going to other townships and to other schools. This is what they're hoping. And so that's, I think, the sort of next phase that will continue is, you know, helping children process what they're going through, helping them find a way of thinking about the future, because I think this concept of continuous traumatic stress is really, it's so present and future-based of all the stresses that they're living with, their conditions and pandemic, and then the whole thing of school closures, you know, that they've lost some of their links to the environment where they feel safe and where they feel their growth is really being facilitated. Mm.
That's that chorus that's so vital.
Mm.
Now, there's also a chorus, if you will, of administrators. There's the American component, there's you in London, and there's the South African component. How is that changing as this gets further developed?
Well, I think that as time has gone on, and with Dr. Kleinman's wisdom, who's been involved in so many outreach projects all over the world, he really taught me about the importance of letting go and letting the people on the ground, you know, run this project. even though they would like us to be, you know, consulting with them, but really to help them get the confidence that it's their project and they own it. So he has now withdrawn from the meetings. And it's really, for a while, it was in a transition, but it was still me working with them. But it's getting to a point where I think it really is them, and letting it go. And if they want to get in touch and tell us about the how it's going, that's great. But sort of stepping back, I think, is so important, especially when one is, you know, up in the north, you know, northwestern America, or in Britain, and, you know, particularly Britain, which historically has a very complicated relationship with South Africa. And, you know, how one is actually seen in the project, and, you know, on the one hand, idealized as these overseas psychoanalysts, but also quite a lot of suspicion too. You know, what are these people bringing to us? And, you know, why do they want to do it? You know, it's very complicated dynamics, which means that a lot of inner work has to be done. As the originator of the project, I had to do an enormous amount of psychic work in myself, because it almost felt like going back to South Africa in some way. And I haven't lived in South Africa since 1986, which is a very long time ago. So that's really, you know, realizing that one is an expat, also realizing once again that I am a white South African. I am not black. And this is all complicated dynamics.
Let's talk a little more about that. You, as I mentioned earlier, you really embrace this daunting challenge. And others like this. This is just the one we're focusing on today. But I know your work in other areas, and it's vital work. Tell us a little bit. What brings you to this?
Well, I think I was sort of brought up in a family who both my parents were South African, living in South Africa mainly, who both were sort of outreach workers in their own way, although they wouldn't have realized that they were. If I think of my mom, she did some work in the townships. I don't know exactly what she did, but, you know, quite politically aware. And my father, again, at the university, he was deputy vice chancellor of the university at one time, you know, very much involved in trying to help students and change the sort of the demographics of the place. So sort of brought up in a family where it was a very strong message that, you know, that we were privileged and that other people weren't. And, you know, we could do small things to maybe help just a little bit. So I think that sort of stayed with me. From, you know, from my adolescence onwards.
Jenny, your work is really an inspiration. It's we're going to make a link on the show notes for people who want to make contact with the organization, with the workbook, to really see what this is. And undoubtedly, it has application in communities worldwide. And for people who want to apply it to their communities, your work and building on Dr. Kleiman's work is a great place for them to start. And they'll be able to make contact with you and your organization through these links. But I want to thank you, not just for this, but as I say, you and I work together on the IPA in Health Committee, and you're always a fountain of not only creative ideas, but of a real energy and delicate attention to many of the things you've described today, the cultural nuances, the importance of speaking the language of the people you're working with, and that basic analytic function that we know so well in the office, you really apply on a large scale, and it's a beautiful example of the off-the-couch work that psychoanalysts do. thanks so much for sharing. Thanks so much for your work. And we're going to remain in touch. It's the pleasure that I'm going to have. Thanks so much for talking today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.